Hello, just a quick note up front before we get started with the episode that our next Patreon trivia night will be May 11th. That's a Wednesday night at 10 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Pacific time. If you guys want to come to a trivia night hosted by me, meet some of your other listeners, and maybe even win some prizes, just go to patreon.com/theroadtonow. If you're already there, thank you. See you on May 11th.
The Jonathan Haidt article, I was very familiar with.
Yeah.
That was... Ready? Oh, yeah. Yeah, I read it last... It came out last week.
Yeah.
A week and a half ago. Yeah. That has been big news on CNN, MSNBC, and Smirconish. My three main sources.
That's funny.
That's the most important article of the year, maybe of the decade.
Really? I mean, I thought it was good. I just subscribed to The Atlantic and basically read them cover to cover.
You don't think it's important?
I think it's important.
He summed up this part, the past 20 years.
I'm Ben Sawyer.
I'm Bob Crawford.
And this is The Road to Now, and you are walking into this conversation with Bob Crawford and I. Right now, we are discussing a new article that I read in The Atlantic. Because I'm old school. I still get the paper Atlantic, and I read it. And I went camping last weekend and took it with me and sat like a nerd and read it. The article is Why the Past 10 Years of American Life Have Been Uniquely Stupid by Jonathan Haidt. It's subtitles. It's not just a phase. And, Bob and I just started talking about it. I sent it to Bob and said we should discuss it because I thought it hit some themes that we've spoken with, like Roger McNamara, Roger McNamee and some other, guests we've had on in the past. And apparently while I have, you probably noticed, maybe you haven't, that I'm limitedly on social media. I've been very busy. But apparently, while I was reading this in a camping chair in Henry Horton State Park, this thing blew up. So that's what I wanted to talk about today. Bob's already heard about it. Bob, what are your thoughts on it?
Well, the article, Ben, I'm going to summarize it for myself, right? And then if you think I got something wrong, please chime in here. The article summarizes what has happened in the world since the 2010s. And it basically he starts out by he draws a parallel to the story of the Tower of Babel in Genesis, in the book of Genesis in the Bible, and how, you know, people had society, the world at the time had built this tower to the sky, and God's like, man, they're gonna be able to get to me, you know, everybody works together so well. I am going to, and in some interpretations, the tower collapses and others, it doesn't. But the point is God makes it so language and communication, no one can understand each other anymore. Everyone, in order to prevent humanity from touching God, God makes it so there's these language and communication barriers with people. So far, so good, Ben?
Yeah, the story's very confusing. Okay. God's like, I'm going to divide you guys. You'll be fighting each other forever. And then he's like, sorry, I got to send my son to sort this shit out later on. Anyway.
Well, that's Archean theology. That doesn't exist anymore. That will be rebranded as something else someday at some point. In the meantime, Jonathan Haidt, the author, draws the parallel, the story of the Tower of Babel, to what is going on right now. And let's just say this, it's all over the world, right? But with social media and the tribalism that has overtaken us, where there are two sets of interpretations of the Constitution, two sets of economic ideas. I took notes. Two different Americas, two different interpretations of the Constitution, economics, and American history. And the reason why we are living in the age of stupid is because we don't understand each other anymore, and we're living in different realities. And the author pins the blame on, well, he says that successful democracies have three things going for them. They've got social capital, strong institutions, and shared stories. And because we can no longer communicate with each other, all three of those pillars of a strong democracy are crumbling. The main thing to blame here, and I think Ben and I have been saying this for years, and I know it's social media. And because of social media, at some point when Facebook invented the like button, was it Facebook who invented the like? When the like, retweet, and share created a performative nature to society. Society became performative. From there, it was the evolution of the manipulation of algorithms. You mentioned Roger McNamee. And it is now the fame of ignominy. It encourages the like button, retweet button, share button, makes us want to perform for one another, which encouraged dishonesty.
Yeah.
And social media has both magnified and weaponized the frivolous. And basically he says that what social media has done over the past, I guess, decade plus, is it's like giving a loaded gun to a four-year-old. And because of that, and this is on the right and the left, and what I love about this, and this is it's about an hour long read.
Yeah.
If you let the audio play, Atlantic has a great, they're connected to Audible, so you can listen to the article. Sounds like it's being read by a human. It's really well read. And it takes about 53 minutes to get through it.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know how long it took me to read it, but it was a while. And I read the text version. It's a thinker too. You kind of got to sit back and think about it at moments.
You do have to think about it. You have to, you know, and Ben, you sent two articles and I believe I'm glad you did that because I couldn't help but synthesize them and interact. My mind interacted between the two of them.
Yeah. Well, let's stick with the first one first.
Sure.
I really want to stick with this genre.
By the way, the first one could be a whole show.
It could be. So first of all, shout out to The Atlantic. All right. I mean, let me be clear. We're not sponsored.
This is every week.
We are inspired by them. I mean, I still get the paper magazine. I was reading it while I was proctoring a final exam earlier. Anyway, it's just fantastic. And I will say that if you're looking for good analysis by people who generally are not playing party politics, like, I mean, it's my salvation sometimes when I just sit down and be like, oh my God, reason. It's amazing.
Well, this article, Ben, it's a pox on both your houses.
Yes, it is. And this is the thing, Bob. Yes. Okay. It's like handing a gun to a four-year-old. And I like that analogy. All right. Because it's a new thing to us, right? Do we blame social media? All right. If a four-year-old is irresponsible with a gun, yes, we blame someone else because a four-year-old shouldn't be able to get a gun. But when the child matures, the child is responsible, becomes an adult, and they're responsible for their own actions. At this point, we could blame social media for what they did because it was clearly, clearly malicious. Like, it was clearly meant, well, I wouldn't even say it's malicious. I would say it was profit motivated and everything else was incidental. I mean, I think if this would have turned out a different way, who cares? They're just trying to keep us on there to sell advertising. But they figured out how to do it, and they were negligent. And it took us a long time to figure this out. Now we know it. And at this point, we're not the four-year-old anymore. We're becoming mature. This is a different world that we're living in. And we need to step up and be responsible for these things. You know, if you find yourself only coming across things that you agree with, like, that's a sign. It's not a sign that you're intelligent or right. It's a sign that these programs have figured you out. So get out there and engage other people. I think what I like in this is, and he walks it through, like, basically how, you know, if you guys are old like me, you remember when these things first came out, MySpace and Facebook, and you literally were just pumped to be able to connect with people you hadn't seen in a long time. And you were like, oh, I can see what they're up to. Oh my God, that person's doing well. Like, you see these things. And it was pretty honest early on. And then it became about the performance. And the problem is that, like, when you're searching for likes, when you're trying to actually, like, game this thing as they incentivize you to, no longer do you have any interest in just like, you know, a lot of people showing general pictures of their family or like what they're up to. It becomes about performance, need to put the perfect picture on there, needing to make your life curated almost. And it, I think in a way it distorts what matters for us as individuals, because we're playing that game all the time and we forget that like those things only matter in this game that is Facebook. And that's a problem we've got to monitor in our own selves. But that's where he's saying it, like it incentivizes dishonesty, right? Because you're trying to present yourself a certain way. You're trying to get clicks and likes. And because of that, and because of the fact that it will steer you towards what will keep you on there longer, it steered us into two completely different realities. But here's the thing, Bob, it hasn't. We think it has because we've let it, but we still live in the same reality. And I mean, whereas we have to regulate this stuff. I mean, there's no way, at least the algorithms, and it's a complicated thing. I feel like there has to be some sense of like, all right, we can't fix everything ourselves, but there is some individual responsibility in this, not to play the game, to say if we're going to be thinking people, if we're only seeing things that agree with us, we owe it to ourselves and to our democracy to actually get out there and look at different opinions and to not let those algorithms be the moderator of other people's stories for us. And that's the bigger phenomenon that I see here, is that instead of people going out and going out and talking to people, going out and interacting with people, they decide that they know the people from what an algorithm or a talking head, and this is a longer trajectory I think has to be included, like Rachel Maddow or Tucker Carlson, what they tell you the other side wants. And we're not letting people tell their own stories for themselves anymore. Ironically, even though we have the biggest outlet possible to tell our stories on. And this all goes back to the same problem that I see. He identifies three solutions here, and I think they're really good, because this is one of those good things where he says, yeah, all right, there's a problem. Let's talk about solutions. The first one he puts forward, I think, to me, is the rock one. It's hardened democratic institutions. Like, right. You've got to defend against this stuff.
And how do you do that? Open primaries.
Open ranked choice voting.
So first you have the open primary, and then so many get into the final round, and then you rank choice voting.
Right. And this to me was like revolutionary, because the first time I heard about this in California, and for those of you guys who don't understand this, an open primary is every competitor goes into a first round. And then of that first round, the top two or three people move on to the actual election. So the primary isn't a party primary. It's actually like all the candidates in the primary. And what this ends up doing is then allowing, like, say, for example, you live in a district where you have an extreme, one of these like, you know, extreme left or extreme right wing candidates who is talking crazy, you know, that nobody really identifies with. If they just go into a partisan primary, the people that are the most motivated often are going to go in and vote for the people who have the most, you know, the most extreme points, because they, you know, people who are radicalized are active. But if you do this in a district, like you have a solidly Republican district and you got one person that's all election was stolen, blah, blah, blah. And then you've got a second Republican who is saying, is talking reasonably about actual like values and policies. That means that you're not going to get the crazy person coming out of the Republican Party as the only option for Republicans. So when it goes to a runoff, you can have two or three moderate, one crazy person and two or three moderates at the top. So that allows for people who have more moderate points of view to vote for the final candidate. And most Americans do have more moderate points of view.
Well, and the example he gives in the essay is Lisa Murkowski in Alaska. And
right.
Alaska has the open primaries and the ranked choice voting. And here you have a politician who's been incentivized to challenge the rightward tilt of her party. She's a moderate Republican, and she's one of the few that have stood up to Donald Trump when he was in office. And she continues to vote independently of her party. Latest example being the affirming Judge Ketanji Brown Jackson, of which only she was one of a few Republicans to vote for.
Three in the Senate, I think it was, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you should want your elected officials to feel like they can represent the majority view on something instead of kowtowing to like a party line. I mean, that doesn't matter who you are. You should want them to represent you instead of a party line. And when a lot of these people that are in tight contests end up in situations where they realize that if they don't toe the party line, someone's going to come in and fund a competitor to primary them. And that competitor will certainly toe the party line. Like that makes it like these people who are informed on decisions they're making, ideally. I don't know that mine always is. I once watched Marsha Blackburn reading a book during the impeachment hearing, which to me was remarkable because I feel like if I put on social media or on national television that I was not doing my job while I was supposed to do my job, I feel like I would have gotten fired. And I feel like most of us would, but that's a special thing for Marsha Blackburn. Anyway, but you could expect that they would be informed and then have more latitude to act on that information as opposed to the talking points we get fed to us by, you know, by the media and by, you know, interested parties. I like that. My other one he doesn't have in here, and this is the thing I've been saying forever, Bob. If you could give me a 28th Amendment, my God, it would be to apply the 2/3 threshold to Supreme Court appointments in the Senate. For those of you guys that don't know.
Didn't they have that?
No.
And then they rolled it back.
Well, they had a 60 vote majority.
Right.
But in the Constitution, it lays out the powers of the Senate over the executive. And it says that because the executive acts as the head of foreign relations, you know, a chief diplomat, they can negotiate the treaties, but foreign treaties have to be approved by 2/3 of the Senate.
Right.
Right. And then it says the Senate shall advise and consent on Supreme Court. Like basically has to get, it's been interpreted.
Right. And it was traditionally before Harry Reid actually got rid of the 2/3 majority for that was like
was
the rules
two-thirds
of the
or was
Senate.
It 60?
It was 60, which if you have 100, that's 2/3, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, so, 100 is like 66, 67.
Well, I mean, it was
it's closer.
It was a 60 vote, I believe a 60 vote threshold, which is roughly 2/3. And then Harry Reid got rid of it to overcome Republican opposition to lower court judges. And then McConnell put it in place for the Supreme Court or took it away completely for Supreme Court justices.
And this is the problem because the current way it's laid out, there's no threshold in the Constitution, which means that the Senate sets its own rules for how many people have to vote on it, which allows this type of partisan stuff to get in the way and to actually politicize an institution that for most, not all, but most of its 230-year history has maintained dignity. And right. Now it's not going to happen because you get 51 senators and a president in their party. They're gonna pick the person that's the most politically expedient for them. If you have a 2/3 standard, that means you're going to have to win people from the other party to get people in this organization.
There's a 60 vote threshold to get anything done, except I think they've rolled it back for like passing the debt limit and things like that, right?
Yeah.
But remember, it's Democrats this year that wanted to completely get rid of 60 votes. So they could pass voting rights legislation.
Yeah. And this is why it's bad to leave it to them in a highly politicized era. And if we right. take it out of their hands, then we actually have the interest of the vast majority that's represented and not their own petty, very myopic interests.
So one of the other solutions recommendations he puts to save our democracy is to reform social media.
Yeah, reform social media. Absolutely.
And the problem with this is people have believed that, you know, any government intervention or government controls on social media would ultimately devolve into censorship.
Yeah. See, here's the problem, I would say, Bob. It depends on what you mean by censorship. There's a world in which you could not have an algorithm that selects the thing that is most likely to get you worked up and it has absolutely no regard for whether or not that's true. You could allow that to continue to exist and say that if you do not allow it's a private company. If you don't allow them to use their algorithms to completely whip up people by selecting what they see, then that's a repression on speech. That's not true. You can still say whatever you want to, but we're not gonna create QAnon by realizing it gets you worked up, makes you see more ads, and then, you know, be damned whatever happens after that.
Reading from the article briefly, he writes, the Facebook whistleblower Francis Haugen advocates for simple changes to the architecture of the platforms. Rather than for massive and ultimately futile efforts to police all content, for example, she suggests modifying the share function on Facebook so that after any content has been shared twice, the third person in the chain must take the time to copy and paste the content into a new post. So this is not censorship, but it makes it a little bit harder to spread misinformation or even, like you say, information that gets people fired up.
Yeah. Well, like, look, here's another way to do that. Bob, we don't see everything the people we follow post. It's all selected. I mean, like, what of that we see is motivated? I mean, if you've got like a team page, like the Road to Now page, like we've got, you know, thousands of people that like it there, but they basically won't show it to most people unless we pay to have it sponsored. Right. So that doesn't come through. That's a decision. Okay. You could do that for like pages, right? But for organizations or whatever, but for individuals, how about letting the individuals themselves either choose to see everything that's posted so they can scroll through it, whatever. Then maybe you won't follow people, or you can choose to like actually not select them, or you could pick the top 10 people you want to always see things from. Give the curation outlet to the people to decide what they want to see, and don't default them into an algorithm that selects things based upon nobody, no individual's interest except for the company. And I think the problem with that is it would offend the absolute most important thing in most of these things, which is profitability. They'd be like, well, people are scared. They're not seeing ads.
Sorry.
Yes, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I get to the point where I say, or I'm at the point where I say, if it wasn't for Road to Now or, you know, Concerts of Change or this and that, I wouldn't be on social media. Just happier without it. If we weren't on social media, and Joe Kwan and I talk about all the time getting the Avid Brothers off social media, but it's just not possible. It's not possible. So, because if, you know, if say we got off Facebook and something happened at a concert, we had to tell everybody this has been delayed or this is canceled or watch out, be careful of this when you're coming out to the show. There's no way that Facebook is the way to reach people immediately, right?
Yeah. And it has that value.
What is the, how could we promote Road to Now but not be on social media? Is there a way for us to let people know that this exists and to tune in? And if you tune in, this is what you're going to hear on a weekly basis. Is there a way to do that without Twitter and Facebook or Instagram?
I mean, I think there is a way to, I mean, mailing lists, I guess, the old email mailing list. Oh, but that doesn't get to people immediately.
No, not email, like, literally, like, have everybody who likes this show send us their address.
A fan club?
And we'll send them, like, once a month, we send them a card, and it's got, like, a little postcard, and it says, this date, this episode airs with this guest, this date, this episode airs with this guest.
But, I mean, that would be great, but, like, I still want, like, Bob, our mission when we started this was to share good ideas with new people, right? And so, like, that still binds us. But I don't think it's all or none, Bob. Like, I mean, the thing that I've realized
is, it can't be, right? This is the, like, new take. We can't go back. And he points that out as well, that we can't go back.
So we can't fix the big problem without, I think, these regulations, right? But we all have a choice as individuals to use these things responsibly.
It's like, but we can't leave it up to people to make good decisions. You can't count on people to make good decisions, because you know why? They're people, and people tend to, this one included, you know, often not make the right choice. You know, it just, this is the way humanity is. This is a human problem. If you have if you give someone the temptation that if they show off a little bit, they're going to get a lot of attention. They're going to, if you're listening, I'm showing off.
Showing off right now.
This is what showing off looks like.
Showing out with Ben and Bob.
They're going to do it because there's something in your brain that feels good when people go, "Oh, you're so great." You know, people like that. People like getting attention. So, I mean, introverts, I don't know if they like getting attention, but extroverts love getting attention. They seek it. And I think some of these people who are like some of the real like bomb throwers in the world and social media or talk radio, or they realize that if you talked about somebody a couple of weeks ago who was like a legit scientist or historian, and then they realized that if they said a certain thing, they got more likes or attention. So now that person is completely in this bonzo world. I can't remember who it was you were talking about, Ben, but I mean, Jordan Peterson. So, I mean, if the temptation is there, people are going to like perform and be dishonest to get attention. That's going to happen.
Yes. And what I'm saying is there is, and I agree with you totally, right? I mean, this whole idea that like we individually recycling ourselves could somehow save the planet that came out in the 90s and early 2000s, that was such an insane facade, right? You have to have structural change. What I'm saying though is that like there is that structural change that needs to happen. But there's a world, and I feel like I might be in it right now, where you go to social media and you get what's useful. You just turn blinders on to all the incendiary stuff. You observe it and you say, what's useful here? I'm constantly finding new interesting things on Twitter that I just kind of scroll through all the garbage. I don't feel like I need, when somebody's out there saying something ridiculous, I don't feel like I need to be like, oh yeah. It's like, I just go, well, what's useful here? And then you actually go to accounts you're interested in instead of just scrolling through everything. And I know, and this is more work, and I'm not saying that this is a solution to the problem, not at all. I'm saying that for those of us who find the value in it right now and also find it getting us whipped up, being conscientious about the way you use it can actually change what you get out of it, and it's not going to fix it. But I think I found individually anyway, I can improve it. Like,
but then you're right now, the people that are going to hear you are the people that already know that, and they probably already do that. You know what I'm talking about? Like,
yeah, oh, sure, sure.
Some people that don't like us or don't agree with us don't listen to us.
Yeah, I know.
Like, we had those people for a little while, and then they just really got sick of us, and they're done.
Apparently, we were too woke.
We were too whatever, yeah, too woke.
Look at us, just two middle-aged white guys being too woke over here. You know what I'm saying? That's the reason both of us are political independents and often find ourselves at odds with everyone. On issues, I take it as a mark of honor, you know.
I think that, and then the third reform, by the way, is he says that we need to prepare the next generation to live, be civically active, and to live with social media. And the best way to do that, he says, is tell your kids to go outside and play with other kids, lightly supervised, so yeah, they can work out those human skills. Which has been hard.
Kids run wild
with the pandemic.
Yes, it has.
It's been hard, and our children are scarred. You know, they're scarred from that time.
Yeah, but we got to push them through it. We got to get them out there, guys. Get your kids out there. When I took Solomon camping, his favorite thing was he was like, I can just get on my bike and take off anytime I want to, because there were a bunch of other parents around there from his school. And you know what my favorite part about it was, too, Bob? It was that he could get on his bike and take off anytime he wanted to. It was amazing. That's when I read this article. And Bob, I think we're going to have to wrap now. We don't have time to get to the second article, but we will talk about it later on.
Oh, you got to go.
Got to go proctor and exam, Bob.
Oh,
you
gotta go. Man.
It's final exam day around here.
Maybe we'll do a part two to this.
Let's do a part two. I'm around this weekend. Thank you for listening to another episode of The Road to Now. If you enjoyed this episode, please help us spread the word. Text a link to a friend, share a link on social media, or just take a minute to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. That's how word spreads. You could help us with that. Speaking of helping us with that and everything else, we'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians. Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Big White, Peggy Donica, Matt Williams, Team Martin, Ann Williams and Frank Edwards, Daniel Hansen, Nate Farrer, and Jennifer N. Magnolia. That list keeps getting longer. Thank you. If you enjoyed The Road to Now, or just want to see how long that list has to get before I pass out reading it, support us on Patreon. That's patreon.com/theroadtonow. We got extra episodes there, bonus materials, and they're all there for you. That's patreon.com/theroadtonow. For more on our podcast, you can visit our website, theroadtonow.com. Easily search our back catalog, quickly find links to content, and when you get there, you'll notice, wow, it's a pretty good website. You want to know why? Because it was designed by Seven Ages Design. Go check those guys out if you need a website. They're fantastic. The Road to Now is hosted and produced by Bob Crawford and Ben Sawyer. Our associate producer is Gary Fletcher, and our theme music is by Paul DeFiglia. For Bob Crawford, this is Ben Sawyer. Take care, and thanks for listening.